Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 349 for December 24th, 2011. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes.
I have a feeling some people would blanch if they knew what the auction values of the bottles we opened at his wake was.
I'm willing to bet that you've never heard of Mike Pedlipski, but without his early work on the development of the internet, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast right now. Mike was also a whiskey connoisseur and may well have been the first whiskey blogger, well, before we'd ever even heard of blogs. Mike died earlier this year. Bill Ricker is the keeper of Mike's whiskey and computer writings. He'll tell us more about his friend and Mike's quest to find the best whiskey in the world. That's coming up later on, along with the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, along with the Villeroy & Bock Whiskey Trivia Contest question. First off, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you, as always, by Glenmorangie. Last month, blended malt became the standard term of reference for Scotch whiskies with malts from more than one distillery, but no grain whiskies in the mix. Diageo is phasing out the one blended malt in the Johnnie Walker range. Green Label was once known as Johnnie Walker Pure Malt until that term was taken out of use several years ago. Now comes word that Green Label will be taken out of the lineup. It's expected to be available in the U.S. until July of 2013, but may be out of stock in other markets before then. For instance, Striding Man Society members in South Africa have already been told that no new stocks will be available. There's no word yet on whether something else will replace it in the Johnnie Walker range. In other news, Ben Rioch has released a new version of its Solstice single malt. It's a 17-year-old edition, and just like last winter's 15-year-old version, it's a heavily peated malt matured in ex-bourbon casks and bottled at 50% ABV. The new Solstice will be available in limited quantities worldwide. Bal Blair is re-releasing its oldest vintage with new packaging. The Bal Blair 1965 single malt remains the same inside the bottle, but gets a new leather-lined wooden gift box. You'll find my tasting notes for the Bal Blair 1965 at the Whiskey Cask website. Now, if you're still looking for a whopper of a Christmas gift, it might be worth heading for Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, where a single bottle of the Dalmore from 1926 has gone on sale at the Finest Spirits and Cigars shop in Departure Lounge 3. The Dalmore Brilliance Vintage 1926 has whiskies from casks filled in 1868, 1878, and 1926, and will come with a diamond stopper weighing almost 2 carats. The price, 250,000 euros, or about $326,000. By the way, the buyer gets to have that stopper turned into a custom piece of jewelry, just in case you needed another incentive. That's just another step in White & Mackay's move away from selling bulk scotch for blending and private label sales toward the premium market. However, that move has come at a cost. White & Mackay's latest financial report shows profits for the last year fell 60% as the company put more money into brands and marketing. Company officials say the move may look bad in the short term, but is paying off in increased sales of Jura and Dalmore single malts. Teachers Blended Scotch is releasing a premium 25-year-old version, along with a single malt version of Teachers. Both whiskies will debut in India, but plans are to make them available worldwide. The 25-year-old expression is the oldest Teachers ever released, while the single malt version is actually from Ardmore Distillery near Aberdeen, which provides the so-called fingerprint malt for Teachers. It's being branded as Teachers Single Malt Whiskey from the Ardmore Distillery. Now, Beam already sells Ardmore as a single malt under its own name. No word on whether that will change. Meanwhile, an Indian court has issued an injunction against two local distillers for using Scotch-like names and packaging on their whiskies. The order bans Glenmond Distillers and Vintners and Imperial Distillers and Vintners from referring to Glenmond, Royal Barrel, and F&G brands as Scotch whiskies, or, in Glenmond's case, using any version of the word Glen on the label. Both companies are appealing the ruling in Indian courts. Last time around, I reported Beam's $95 million deal to buy Ireland's Cooley Distillery. Now, Cooley founder and chairman John Teeling has told the Irish Times that he and his shareholders had little choice. He believes Cooley will be able to triple in size over the next decade with Beam's ability to invest more in marketing and promotion. Finally, if you're thinking of attending the Spirit of Speyside Whiskey Festival this coming May, mark January 21st on your calendar. That's when the festival's schedule of events will be released and tickets go on sale. The festival will run from May 3rd through the 7th. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Unnecessarily well made. December's edition of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings is available for downloading now. This month, our tasting panel of Jeff Steuben, Simon Seaton, and Kevin Andreessen tasted a series of white whiskeys, including Original Moonshine, Buffalo Trace's Weeded Mash White Dog, and White Owl Canadian Whiskey. You can find WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings at the WhiskeyCast website and in the iTunes Music Store. It's brought to you by Kilhoman. Let's check the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. Josh Scott asked me on Facebook this past week whether I've had a chance to watch the new Discovery Channel series Moonshiners. He said it's pretty good, other than the all-too-obvious perpetuated stereotypes. I have not had a chance to watch it yet, but I'm going to try to catch up on the first few episodes over the holidays. Now, this week we reached 2,000 likes on the Facebook page, and while I'd like to thank all of you for your support, I'm not quite sure who was number 2,000 specifically. Ian Katunovich said he'd be glad to take the credit since no one else stepped forward. However, I happen to know he was on the list much, much earlier. Christopher Winters had this wisecrack. He bets it was Johnny Depp. You may remember the story a few weeks ago about Depp's desire to be buried in a whiskey cask and the flood of hits our website received after a few media outlets translated that as whiskey cast. In any case, thanks again for being part of our community this year. If you have questions or suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. You can always post something on the Facebook page or just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the comments of the week are brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a Whiskey Insider today. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you as always by Laphroaig. The Brandy Library in New York City has added spirit school classes during the holiday week, with a class on rare and precious bourbons on the 28th, a rare and precious scotch class on the 29th, and a special New Year's Eve tasting on Saturday the 31st. The Scotch Whiskey Experience in Edinburgh will host a Hogmanay Distillers Fair this coming week on the 29th and 30th. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary will hold what it's calling the Ultimate Glenmorangie Tasting on January 12th. The Universal Whiskey Experience Dalmore Dinners wind up with events in San Francisco on January 17th, Los Angeles on the 18th, and Las Vegas on the 19th. Tickets are also on sale now for the Universal Whiskey Experience Nth event in Las Vegas, March 2nd and 3rd. I've been given discount codes for WhiskeyCast listeners that I'll post on our Facebook page. The Victoria Whiskey Festival in Victoria, British Columbia is coming up the weekend of January 20th through the 22nd, and I'm looking forward to making the annual trip out to Victoria for that one. And finally, if you're interested in learning how to distill whiskey, Catoctin Creek in Purcellville, Virginia will host a distilling workshop January 14th, and Rocktown Distillery in Little Rock, Arkansas will host its own distilling class on January 29th. You'll find links for all of these events and a full calendar of events for 2012 at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig, which wishes you happy holidays and reminds you to drink responsibly as you're celebrating with friends and family.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
Redbreast is a reflection of Irish whiskey as it used to be and always should be, in that it reflects the pot still style, which is the tradition of Irish whiskey going back over the years. And if you take Redbreast, there's an age statement on the label, 12 years old. And that means that the youngest whiskey in that bottle is 12 years old. Doesn't mean that all the whiskey's 12 years old, because to get the mix right and the style, all the flavour characteristics right, We will use a range of ages, the youngest being 12, but, you know, it can be a few years older and that to get the whole thing together as I want it to be.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, know Redbreast.
Time now for Whiskey Cast in depth. Every one of us has many facets to our life. They're areas that may be completely opposite from each other, but put together, they paint a complete picture of us. Software engineering requires discipline, rigor, and precision, since a simple error in coding can cause all kinds of problems if the software even manages to run at all. On the other hand, nosing and tasting single malt scotch and other whiskeys requires a creative and flexible mind in tune with one's senses. Mike Pedlipski had both facets in what was clearly a well-lived life. He died earlier this year, leaving behind archives of his work in both software and whiskey, and a story that will touch the heart of any true whiskey lover. Bill Ricker was one of Mike's closest friends and is now the keeper of both legacies. Before we talk about Mike and his whiskey career, I do want to pay tribute to the fact that basically without a lot of his early work in conjunction with the development of the internet, we wouldn't be doing this interview at all right now, because tell me what Mike invented in terms of internet protocols, not necessarily the IP that we all know of as internet protocol, but some of the methodologies that we now use that are standard that he was very much responsible for.
Well, he was part of a large team. He was MIT's representative on the engineering task force that built the internet, and so negotiated the definitions of these protocols. Degree of responsibility varied from campus to campus for different ones in the early days. He set up the first method of transferring email between different brands of computers back when there were more brands, and every email system was its own separate thing, and you were lucky to get it between brands of computers of the same brand, let alone to different brands. But the TCP/IP protocol stack, which was a replacement for the previous DARPANET stack, which made expanding the internet to networks of networks possible, was something he was intimately involved with you know, a number of other people, some of whom have already sadly passed on also. That generation is starting to fail. And he was one of the key defenders of the TCP/IP stack when certain government entities in the mid to late 80s, early 90s were trying to mandate use of the ISO OSI stack, which is bureaucratic to the nth degree, and it would not have made for a nice internet.
And for non-techies, the stack is basically the essentially the software inside the operating system that lets computers talk to each other. Just to put it in a really, really dumbed down version in layman's terms, basically that's how it allows the two of us to talk via Skype. It allows all of our web communications and basically almost everything we do on the internet.
Absolutely. It's all built on top of that.
And he was also heavily involved in developing the Telnet and FTP protocols that let computers talk to each other and transfer files like WhiskeyCast as an audio file back and forth between computers, right?
Absolutely. At a early computer conference, he and some friends of his from other facilities did the first three-way Telnet from the Texas Instruments booth in the show using their new terminal with the built-in modem, which was an acoustic cup. You crammed the phone into two cups on the back of the terminal.
Believe it or not, I actually remember those. The old handset with the screw-on earpieces, and you'd jam
yes.
this thing down. They sold them. I think Radio Shack didn't even have these things. You had to get them out of a catalog, right?
Well, they eventually had them.
Eventually, but not at
but,
first.
Yeah. This terminal was portable, had heat-sensitive paper in an ugly grid characters, and had the acoustic coupler built right into it so you could take it with you. It was the original portable.
Now, how did you meet him?
I met Mike at work. I was a defense contractor back in the Reagan era, working computer security research, and network protocol architecture was, for the Defense Department, a security issue. So Mike was our protocol guru in the network and computer security department at a research and engineering establishment that was technically a non-governmental organization, but the Air Force was the only shareholder.
Not unlike many companies in the Washington area and not in Silicon Valley at the time that were pretty much government entities at the time, right?
Well, this was legally a government-created entity. They needed federal contract research centers that would be not government, not civil service, but would be nonprofits and answerable to the government. To serve as honest third parties between the government contracting offices and the for-profit contractors that actually built things. So like the RAND Corporation is the best-known example.
Right.
Yeah, we were just the East Coast version of that sort of thing. Our department didn't do Air Force stuff. We did other stuff. I mostly worked with the Navy.
And, of course, all of it's still classified.
I didn't do anything that was classified. The modern security features you see in databases and operating systems came out of that group also.
So, in reality, what you and Mike did was basically build together a lot of what we have today that we now use as commonplace that that kids are using, basically.
I won't take credit for what the rest of the group did there. I was having fun around the edges and went off to try to do artificial intelligence and wound up doing object-oriented instead and had fun anyway.
And how did you guys both wind up getting into whiskey? Because I'm not sure whether you got into whiskey first or Mike got into whiskey. So tell me that story.
No. I'd started out... on cognac, which I learned to drink on a conference committee working with one of the guys profiled in Tracy Kidder's book, Soul of a New Machine, who was on our Northeast Conference Committee for the ACM, same time I was. That was when I was between jobs and was working on my paperwork to go back to the research engineering place, which I'm carefully not naming. And so while I was waiting for that paperwork to go through, I worked this conference, learned to drink cognac. And then Mike had been drinking whiskey for a long time and researching it seriously for 5, maybe 10 years at that point. And fairly soon after we... got to know each other, invited me over and treated me to some Highland Park.
And it went downhill from there, right?
Yeah, I haven't looked back at cognac much since then.
Now, how did he get to be so much of a whiskey connoisseur? I know you shared some of his tasting notes with me. That he was writing literally 20, 25 years ago before we had even the Michael Jackson books, let alone Jim Murray's Whiskey Bible. And he was writing very detailed tasting notes on many of the whiskeys that were around back in the early 90s and before then.
And was sharing them online when online was a much smaller world. He'd been intrigued by whiskeys, but was really taken with Scotch single malts when a friend of his quit the high-tech industry because the lady he married wanted to be a tree farmer. And so they went off to Oregon and set up a tree farm. And the group at, I'm not sure which of the ARPANET nodes the guy was actually at before going farming, got together a group wedding present of a mixed case of random bottles picked up at a local liquor store. And when Mike was next on the West Coast, he was bi-coastal his entire life. He dropped in to visit his friend in Oregon. And the guy served as a after-dinner drink one of the whiskeys from their mutual friends. And Mike decided it was the best whiskey he'd ever had and made a quest to find another bottle of it. That was Glen Grant Army and Navy Stores issue, 14-year-old.
And let's go into the details on this, because this was really only available over in the UK at the time, right?
Yeah, it was bottled for the Army and Navy Stores, which was a chain of stores which are higher class than what we call Army and Navy Stores here in the U.S., which are, you know, surplus stores and hunting goods. And over there it was more catering to the sort of gentlemen who might be officers, I guess. But they had a house bottling of a fairly nice sherried Scotch. And it had gotten somehow, a little bit of it was imported by a U.S. importer distributor, got to this local local wine shop, and Mike eventually found that, you know, there wasn't much distribution of it in the U.S. He checked with, you know, the best whiskey merchants he knew in the Boston area and on the West Coast, got the name of the one where his friends had shopped, and found that what they'd gotten a good price on was the last bottle bin end. And there was none left in the U.S. that he could find. When he got over to London for a NATO technical conference, he checked with the distiller and the new owners of the bottler. Army Navy Stores had been bought by Harrods, who had their own private label, and said Army Navy is not going to have its own label anymore. Glen Grant had been bought, and the new owners said, we don't allow private labeling of our casks. You're not going to sell to those independents anymore. And so it had dried up. There was no more being made.
And what year was this back in? This, because the bottle was, it was bottled back in 1964, right?
Something like that. And it was, we're talking late 70s or early 80s that Mike was starting his search. And so, you know, however many bottles were still around, he basically decided that there was a good chance that his friend's wedding present had been the last bottle unopened on the planet. and so decided that his quest had to be for what the second best whiskey was. And from some of the comments that I'm seeing on the blogs, it is possible that this whiskey was from a Paxaret-treated cask, such that the like of it will never be seen again. Because boiled must mixed with the sherry is not considered legit by current Scottish law, whereas it once was.
Right.
And if this was 14-year-old, bottled in, call it 64, then yeah, 1950, Paxaret barrels were legal. But they were not legal by the time that Mike was looking.
This quest really was his entire focus, and this was back in the day when you couldn't just go online and type in Glen Grant Army Navy Stores 14-year-old and find bottles at auction somewhere and be able to find it like we do today. This was an actual physical, hard, dusty bottle search all over the world, right?
Yes. Working individual contacts in person, and you know, the few whiskey files who were already congregating on an online mailing list. So yeah, it started the hard way.
And it almost might be fair to call Mike one of the first whiskey bloggers with all the tasting notes he was posting and sharing, right?
Absolutely. And the I think the Arpanet malts list is a grandparent of the Malt Maniacs, in that the second generation of that list it went from Malt Cell to MM list to the website structure that it is today.
Wow. A lot of history here. Now, in the search for what he thought was the second best, where was he looking, and what was he finding that was at least coming close to this Glen Grant?
Where he was looking, his primary research site was the old Cairngorm Whiskey Center and Library in Aviemore. Whenever he was over for a NATO conference or other consultations with our European partners, he'd take a few personal days, go up to Scotland and visit the tasting room at the Cairngorm Whiskey Center and take copious notes. And he'd visit distilleries and various friends in Scotland, academics at the university, Charlie Mack, you know, the usual suspects.
Now, this is where the story gets a bit sad, because he found the Holy Grail, but he never lived long enough to enjoy it, right?
Yes, his last act of volition was buying a bottle of 14-year-old Army-Navy Glen Grant on eBay. He had to check himself out of the hospital to complete the transaction, have it shipped to a friend of his, because he realized he was going to have to go back in. And the bottle arrived day and a half after he died.
And that was earlier this year, right?
Earlier this year. The bitter irony is the seller, who'd been in reasonably good health, took an unexpected fall and didn't survive either.
So neither one of them got to enjoy this whiskey.
No.
Now, you have the bottle and are, as you've described, the executor of both the whiskey estate and his literary estate, which involved all of his computer writings, correct?
Correct.
What I want to, because you were kind enough a few weeks ago to let me taste this amazing whiskey, and I got to admit, it was amazing. But I want your tasting notes, because in your world, you have now been able to taste Mike's Holy Grail. So I'd like to get your tasting notes on this.
This is the ultimate sherry bomb, as far as I'm concerned. My suspicion is that it, as I said, it would be a Paxaret treated sherry cask. So this has more of that sherry fruit than you're going to find in anything today. Sweet beyond belief for a whiskey. The 32-year-old Springbank sherry cask that he had comes close.
And he was collecting whiskeys all along during this period. What are you doing with the collection of his whiskeys and his whiskey writings? What are your plans for that, as well as his technical writings?
I'm going to do some work this winter to pull them together into a better website. The basic whiskey tasting notes are still available on the net. If you Google Pedlipsky research notes, whiskey, you'll find it. It's at University of Edinburgh, I think it is.
And please spell out Pedlipsky so that anybody who's listening can find it, because that's going to be a little tricky. It doesn't quite sound the way, or spell out the way it sounds, right?
Well, it spells reasonably well the way it sounds. Padlipsky.
And anybody who wants to search that and Google that can find those notes at the University of Edinburgh. What are the plans for the actual whiskey collection? How many? I have to ask, how many bottles did he not get to complete? And what are the plans for those?
Well, his philosophy was a reference collection. So his goal was not to finish a bottle, but to rebottle it into smaller and smaller bottles as needed. I use argon nitrogen as well as smaller bottles to prevent oxidation as well. And he taught me to use electrical tape to make sure the cork seals are good, and with the goal of preserving a small sample of a old expression of a whiskey to compare against a new expression of it, or if the whiskey stops having that expression, as a resource. So that was his plan. So he had an awful lot of miniatures or dirty bottles, and that's my plan. These aren't investment bottles. I'm not holding them to appreciate. I have a feeling some people would blanch if they knew what the auction values of the bottles we opened at his wake was. The 25-year-old Macallan was already open. The 32-year-old Springbank, I don't think had been the Glenn Grant Army Navy was opened in California before I packed it, because I decided that bottle was bad luck to people that were holding it unopened. It needed to be opened for my safety. and it only gave me a car wreck. It didn't kill me. But we're fine. And we served that at the wake.
Yeah, tell me about this wake, because this must have been a unique experience.
We had a mixed group. Mike was an only child. Several of his MIT classmates were only children, so they formed a pact to be uncles and aunts to each other's kids, so that the kids would have uncles and aunts, particularly since the one gal in the group was dating one of the guys. The kids would have no uncles and aunts. And so the four of them were pledged to be not just godparents, but actual family to each other's kids if any of them should have kids. And two of them did. Well, three of them, since two of them married. Those kids are, aside from the whiskey and the literary rights, Mike's heirs. And we gathered the two remaining classmates, and one of the kids, and Mike's off again on again girlfriend of 40 years. at her house here in Greater Boston, and a number of former work colleagues as well. And we had some of Mike's writings and poems, copy of the book, copies of the whiskey notes, a sample of the collection, and we shared memories, and we had a video greeting testimonial from Vint Cerf, the currently chief internet scientist for Google, who was a principal investigator on the ARPANET project for the government. And so was, from a technical point of view, project leader for the internet. I don't think he was the manager, but he was the one of the chief cat herders.
And often gets the title of father of the internet, unlike Al Gore.
Let's be precise.
I'm being facetious.
But to set the record straight, Al Gore claimed to have saved the internet when the phone company wanted to kill it. And he bought them time and funded development of effectively the web browser. The World Wide Web was invented at CERN, where they just didn't discover the Higgs. But the first nice browser for the web was developed at the National Supercomputer Group in Illinois that was funded by the National Science Foundation and Al Gore to have a fast backbone internet that connected colleges to a supercomputer campus centrally located in Illinois, not quite halfway between the East Coast and the West Coast. And part of their remit was to find a way to share data efficiently over the internet. And they decided that CERN's World Wide Web was good, but they needed a better browser than CERN's browser, so Mozilla was born. And fighting off the phone company and the ISO OSI standards was part of what Al Gore helped with. But part of the argument over father of the internet goes between the software people and the modem people. the lowest level of steering electrons. The people who designed a certain shape of cable or designed the packet switches sometimes try to hog all the credit and cut out Vint Cerf and John Postel. Postel was the librarian for the standards, as it were. He ran the Internet RFC Standards Organization, and so is in Mike's estimation, the equal of Vint Cerf and the other claimants are handmaidens, as Mike would have seen himself as one of the carpenters, not the architect.
And as you pointed out when we started, a lot of these guys, like Mike, have already passed. And we need to keep telling their stories, because what those guys did really did change our world and brought us all closer together. We would not have a worldwide whiskey community without guys like these, right?
Yes, and there is an online mailing list for discussion of internet history, which is largely populated by the guys that helped build it. And the Institute for Internet History is the Postel Center, named for John Postel, at the West Coast UCalifornia Research Institute, ISI, where much of the early work was done and the records are. That institute on the north side of L.A. is the center for internet history.
You mentioned the pact that these folks put together to be aunts and uncles to the kids, if there were any at some point. And that's why you refer to him as Uncle Mike to this day, right?
Well, I'm not part of that.
Right.
I refer to him as Uncle Mike because that was the easiest thing for my daughter, who was 3, to call him, because Mr. Pedlipski was ridiculous and Mike was a little informal. We were colleagues, so he was always just Mike to me. I will occasionally refer to him as Uncle Mike in air quotes, because it's easier than going through the long litany of relationship.
I can tell you miss him just by the tone of your voice, don't you?
Yeah. My Mike was somebody that I'll keep thinking of. Gee, I'd like to ask him that, and I can't.
And I want to thank you for sharing his story with us, because he's a guy I would have loved to have met, and certainly wish I'd had the chance to have him on the show when we had a chance to get him on before he passed. But thank you for sharing his story with us.
Well, you're entirely welcome, Mark.
I've added a link to Mike's existing online tasting notes at the WhiskeyCast website. They were last revised back in 1996, and once Bill has finished reworking them for the web, I'll add a permanent link on the resources page of the WhiskeyCast website. And by the way, when I tasted that Glen Grant from the Army-Navy stores with Bill a few weeks ago, I tried to record my tasting notes as a voice memo on my phone, but I lost them before I could write them down. Maybe that's for the best, but trust me, it really was a great whiskey. In the meantime, the What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by Villeroy & Bock. There's still time to enter the Whiskey Trivia Contest and win a set of fine flavor whiskey glassware. I'll have the question for you in just a minute. First off, let's look at the Balvenie Portwood 21-year-old. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose has notes of red grapes, allspice, and orange peel, aromatic and complex with subtle traces of ginger, too. The taste is thick, mouth-filling, and spicy with good cinnamon and allspice notes, orange peel, licorice, and a touch of raisins that comes out as the spices fade. The finish is lingering and tart with a touch of dry red wine and orange peel. Overall, very complex and smooth. I'm scoring the Balvenie Portwood an 88. Now, the Whiskey Exchange in London recently released a single cask of Glengarry from 1971. It was bottled at 43.9% ABV. Back in 1971, Glengarry was much more heavily peated than it is today, and the nose reflects that with a good smokiness and a touch of pipe tobacco, malty with a hint of nutmeg, too. The taste is creamy and rich with a good balance of smoke and spiciness and a touch of caramel leading into the finish, which is sweet and lingering, as you might guess, with a slight hint of cinnamon to balance things out. I'm scoring the 1971 Glengarry from the Whiskey Exchange a 92. This week's Tasting Notes are brought to you by Villeroy & Bock and the Fine Flavor line of whiskey glassware. It's time for the question in our whiskey trivia contest, and if you can get the answer to this question right, you could win a set of 4 fine flavor nosing glasses and a decanter. I asked the same question last time around. This is the last time we'll ask it, and here it is. I want you to name the distillery managers or master distillers of these 5 distilleries. All of them have been mentioned at least once on WhiskeyCast during 2011. The distilleries: Auchentoshan, Balblair, Bernheim, Highland Park, and Laphroaig. Once again, I want you to name the distillery managers or master distillers at Auchentoshan, Balblair, Bernheim, Highland Park, and Laphroaig. To enter, just click the Whiskey Trivia Contest banner at the WhiskeyCast website and post your answer on Villeroy & Bock's blog before December 31st, 2011. Now, the winner will be selected at random around January 10th, 2012, and you'll find all of the rules at the Villeroy & Bock blog site. The key thing to remember, though, this is open to anyone over the age of 21 worldwide. No geographical restrictions. They'll ship the winner glassware anywhere in the world. Our Whiskey Trivia Contest is brought to you by Villeroy & Bock's Fine Flavor line of whiskey glassware, available at fine retailers and Villeroy & Bock's own stores and e-shops worldwide. Truly glasses worthy of your whiskey. By the way, you'll find my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple edition is brought to you by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is brought to you by Benromic. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links for our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at RedbreastWhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and on behalf of my entire family, my wife Christina, our daughters Brianna, Aria, and Tessa, and the sheepdogs Frizzle and Bristow, I'd like to wish each of you a very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season. Remember, as you're celebrating the holidays, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.